Hello, I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. Of all the many different cases of unexplained events, strange creatures, hauntings and more, there are some which sit in your subconscious once you first find out about them and refuse to go away. They fascinate and intrigue, and they never really do leave. You may forget about them for many years, but then, when something triggers them, you can recall them in great detail and remember where you first learned of them. Arguably one of the greatest examples of this, certainly for me, and I know for many others, comes in the form of Jeff, the talking mongoose, from the 1930s. The case of Jeff is viewed in many different ways. Some see it as a pure hoax, but others believe there was more at work. Some call it a poltergeist case, but with the exception of the case of the haunting of John Wesley's vicarage, there are none with many similarities. Others draw parallels with stories of witches' familiars. This year saw the publication of the definitive study on the subject, the result of 7 years of meticulous research by the book's author. The book is called Jeff, The Strange Tale of an Extra Special Talking Mongoose, and on this edition of the Folklore Podcast, I'm joined by its author, Christopher Joseph, to look at the case of Jeff from the folklore perspective. Now, this episode was originally recorded for release in September of 2017, but between recording and editing, Chris's book was shortlisted for the Folklore Society's prestigious Catherine Briggs Award for New Folklore Books. As a member of the Society, I was compelled to postpone release of the episode until after the judging took place, to ensure that there was no perceived bias. I'm delighted to be able to say that the book was voted to win the award, and makes this episode an extra special interview with which to close this season of the podcast. I hope you enjoy it.
Folklore. The beliefs, traditions, and culture of the people. Passed on in the most part through the spoken word, folklore expresses our values, our shared ideas with others. It is both how we were and how we are. Without a record, our customs and traditions may become lost to us in the present, but under the surface, we still draw on them. We still know. It's time to recall our forgotten history and to record the new. This is the Folklore Podcast.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Folklore Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here.
It's excellent to have you. I have to admit, before we start, that my wife would back me up on this. I have been wandering around with a little bit of a schoolboy grin since we set this interview up. For me, this is quite an exciting interview. And I'll tell you later on why that is the case.
Okay.
Yeah, it's intriguing, I know. But to start with, you're joining us to talk about a very, very interesting case, which will be familiar to some people possibly and not to others. Can we start by just having a bit of a broad overview as to what happened in the case of Jeff the Talking Mongoose?
Right, well, the case began in the autumn of 1931 in a farmhouse in the very rural west of the Isle of Man. And a farming family called the Irvings began to report, they began to claim, perhaps I should say, a little animal that appeared to them sometimes outside in the yard and sometimes inside the house. And it seemed to have power of speech, and very rapidly they taught it how to speak, and then within a few weeks it was, so they claimed, singing and telling jokes and indulging in long drawn out metaphysical discussions. And they claimed it would kind of roam around the neighborhood and come back with gossip of a quite a mundane nature, such as the local farmer, his wife is knitting him a new jumper, or another farmer has lost his sheep. It was all on a very kind of day-to-day level. And quite quickly, in the immediate neighborhood, the word began to spread, and various neighbors, people would go up there. And quite a few people claimed to have heard this talking mongoose speak. A few people said they'd seen it. The Irvin family all claimed resolutely that they'd seen it, and there are photographs they took which allegedly depict the talking mongoose. So by 1932, this was getting to be a news story on the mainland. Initially, a Manchester newspaper journalist was sent over there, and he wrote quite a sympathetic report. And then people like Harry Price, the psychic investigator, got involved and sent up his researchers. And it carried on really for about 8 years, from 1931 through to 1939.
Now, the case for me is very, very interesting. Now, and the reason that I'm so excited about this interview is that this is one case that has stuck with me probably since I was at school. Mm. Now, I remember, as a lot of people of my generation probably do, the school library had certain books that were at the beginning of the run in the 001, if you know your library Dewey Decimal System. I know you would. And so do I. And that is where books on the unexplained were shelved. And among those were things like the Usborne Mysteries of the Unexplained and other... Other books that are now really iconic, I think, in this field. Now, there are certain cases that are discussed in those books that are very well-known cases. Kenneth Arnold and the UFOs, for example. The Brown Lady of Raynham Hall, if you want a ghost photograph. These sorts of cases, they're still very much with us today and still really interesting. But for me, the case of Jeff the Mongoose has resonated somehow and stuck with me over all those number of years. And it's always been a case that has just held a fascination for me. And I guess it was the first case that, as a child in school, interested in these subjects, I really came across and remembered. How did you come to find the case, and what does it mean to you?
Well, like you, I think my first exposure was through the Usborne books in the 1970s. It was either that, or in the 1980s there was a part work called The Unexplained, which ran a very good Jeff the Mongoose story.
I have it next to me on my shelf.
Ah, so like you, Mark, I think my first exposure was to Jeff was either through the Usborne books, or it may have been the 1980s part work serial, The Unexplained. And I kind of, this lay dormant in my mind, I think, until about the year 2000, when I started working at the University of London's Senate House Library. And when you start, you get taken around the different departments and introduced to people. And when I was taken to the archives, the then conservator said, oh, we have Harry Price's archives and letters and correspondence, Harry Price, Lawley Rectory, Rudy Schneider. But my favourite is Jeff the Talking Mongoose. And this kind of triggered off a vestigial memory. And then I used to spend my lunch hours and after work going through the Price's papers. And there's huge numbers of letters from the farmer, James Irvin, very, very repetitive and obsessive when he's describing Jeff's daily activities and his sayings. When I started to do this, I thought it would be a relatively simple matter to establish once and for all whether this was just an out-and-out hoax or whether it was a poltergeist or, you know, collective mental illness. And the more I read these primary sources, the more it seemed to become rather confused, and there's various layers of explanation that are simultaneously happening. So there are certainly elements of quite crude hoaxing. I also suspect there was some kind of collective mental, a kind of folie à plusieurs amongst the three members of the family that may have encompassed other members of the other people in the neighbourhood, in the local area. If you believe in poltergeists, I think there are very great similarities between this case and other poltergeist cases. And the other thing I discovered when I was writing the book was that Jeff bears a very close resemblance in several aspects to house fairies, brownies, hobs, these rather touchy entities that can be very helpful on a farm, and they will look out for rats and catch animals and mow the fields. But you have to treat them right, and if you don't treat them right, they can be very petulant. And it seemed to me, the Isle of Man, I should say, has its very own type of house fairy, and there are stories of this. It's called a Finodery. It's a very touchy, hairy little being who lives in a farm, and again, will help out only if he's treated right. And there were stories in the immediate neighbourhood with which the family would have been very familiar. And Mrs. Irving Margaret had a Manx ancestry on her mother's side. So there are certainly, there are loads of stories of witches, fairies, ghosts, hobgoblins all around this area, which was the most rural, I suppose, the place where the Manx language had just about survived. Sadly, I don't think it has now, but in the 1930s when this was taking place, it was still just about being used. So it's a very traditional area. And I think how I see this case is it's a collision between very traditional farming ways of life and all the folk ways and the myths that go along with that, colliding with modernity, because the Irving family were actually from Liverpool, and they were quite cosmopolitan and sophisticated. The father had been quite a successful sales representative for a Canadian piano and organ company, and he had quite a high standard of living and would travel to Canada. And then suddenly he's kind of plunged into this Celtic rural lifestyle. So sometimes Jeff is said to her, when his speech is recorded, he uses technological terminology like his magic phones and his rectophone. Other times he'll talk about his spirits or he'll talk about goblins. So there's a kind of collision or a mixture, really, between the two.
Yes, it's an interesting mix, isn't it, actually? Now, the case, although it is witnessed or observed or looked into by many people, really centres around this one family in this one location. Now, the Irvings, as you say, they lived in Liverpool, and then they up sticks and they moved from Liverpool to the Isle of Man, and they live in a very, very remote farmhouse at Dawlish Cashen, or Cashen's Gap. And this really is a hugely isolated place, isn't it? I know the farmhouse doesn't exist anymore, but they really had a long way to go before they hit civilization or anything else.
That's right. And although the building itself was demolished in the 70s, you can still go and see the site. And it's about 2 miles away from the nearest village, Dalby. But not an easy 2 miles. There was one footpath that hardly existed, which would, when I was there certainly, would very rapidly become just a marsh and be knee-deep in mud. The other path down to another village called Glen May was a very steep, rocky path, which in wet weather would actually become a stream. It wasn't on a road. They didn't have any neighbours. And perhaps I should say, not only was it remote, it was very, very austere in the sense that they didn't have electricity, they didn't have a telephone or a radio, and they would sometimes be cut off for months at a time. If there was heavy snowfall in winter, they would be just cut off and thrown in on themselves in what was actually quite a small, dark farmhouse. Irving had actually panelled the stone walls with wooden panelling, ostensibly as a kind of insulating device. But this was a very dark stained wood. So there's two. This is mentioned for two reasons. Firstly, that there was a gap of about 4 inches between the stone and the wooden panelling, sufficient for a little animal, arguably, to rush around. It was also suggested that the whole house would act as a speaker, as an amplifier, in that one could speak in one part of the house and that voice would be amplified in another part. They lived a very, very cut-off and remote lifestyle. They didn't have any neighbours. The daughter, Vori, who was 12 years old when Jeff started to appear, was reported as seen wandering the hills, talking to herself or talking to her dog. She was supposedly fond of animals, but very lonely, intelligent, interested in technology. It's been observed that her interests, and indeed her father James's interests, are mirrored by those of Jeff. So Jeff seemed to be interested in different languages, as James did. He seemed to be interested in technology. He'd go down to the airport, apparently, to see the planes coming in. So did Vori. I could go on. There are very great similarities between the minds of the three family and the mind of Jeff.
And that, I guess, could be interpreted in a number of different ways, couldn't it? They're very isolated. So one argument is they concoct this as a hoax, therefore their interests are reflected in that. Another argument might be that being so isolated and so insular is going to lead to some kind of mental projection, possibly, or some kind of mental condition that is going to develop within the family, perhaps.
I've given talks about this various places, and one occasion two psychiatrists from an East London psychiatric hospital turned up, and they had some very interesting comments about this condition, folie à plusieurs, where a whole family will develop delusions or go insane, effectively. And I pursued some of the documented examples of this in history of psychiatry journals. The ones I found were in Ireland, rural Ireland, quite bloodthirsty, where a member of the family would be killed, typically, by other members of the family, which didn't happen in this case, that there was no violence or anything like that. It does suggest how a shared belief system can develop into extreme ways, and it's possible that in the case of the Irvings and Jeff, the extremeness was the Irvings maintaining the absolute truth of what is on the surface an absurd story, but reinforced by the fact that 10 or 20 locals would absolutely swear that they'd heard this voice, and one or two, as I say, even said they'd seen the little animal running around. So it wasn't just a crazy family, but there are certainly instances of examples of them hoaxing. I was thrilled to touch what are supposed to be samples of Jeff's fur. There's some in Cambridge University Library, and when Harry Price investigated this in 1936, 1935, he took some air samples from the Irving sheepdog, Mona, and then he had them analysed and compared by an expert at the Natural History Museum, and sure enough, these were identical. There are also ostensibly footprints. They're supposed to be paw prints Jeff made in some plasticine. And one of the odd things about, well, there are many odd things about Jeff, but one of the odd things about his physical appearance, according to the Irvings, was that his two front paws were much bigger than his rear paws. And he said this was so he could steal objects from local farms, and he used to bang on these wooden walls to keep them awake and generally carry on, be a nuisance. But, you know, there is no animal, especially these kind of weasel, squirrel, polecat type of animal, that has such a disparity between the front paws and the back. And the same expert at the Natural History Museum just said this is a crude hoax. Arguably the photographs of Jeff, which seem to change in each picture, he seems to be a different thing in each picture, they may well be something like rabbit skins, maybe arranged on fences or arranged on edges. So there's no doubt that there is an element of hoaxing, like the Cottingley Fairies, for example. But in my opinion, that doesn't explain the entirety of the case. There's something very obsessive about James Irving's recording Jeff's daily doings, and very mundane they are too, over a period of years.
Yes, and that's an interesting thing in itself, isn't it? Because this case went on for a very long period of years without being revealed as a hoax, despite some fairly hefty investigation by a number of people. It still ran for, what, 7-8 years?
That's right, and arguably there still isn't a definitive resolution, not in the way that the Cottingley Fairies case, you know, the two cousins have admitted that they made those photographs, and that's quite clear-cut. The only, I think, discussion there is one of those women said, oh, we had to fake those photos of fairies because we were seeing the fairies and no one believed us, so we were forced into fake.
That's right. She kind of half retracted it, didn't she, on her deathbed, right, that confession, yeah.
The girl, Vori, when she was much older, she moved to England and was very reluctant to talk about the Jeff case, and she wouldn't really talk about it at all. There was one journalist for an American magazine called Fate who was very persistent and managed to track her down. She'd moved to somewhere near Cheltenham in 1970, and he did persuade her to give an interview. And all she would really say is it was all true. I wish it had never happened. It was a blight on my life. And she describes how she was shunned and people would say she was spooky. And we think of Jeff as the talking mongoose. On the Isle of Man, he was known as the Dalby Spook, Dalby being the nearest village. And apparently her school colleagues would call her the Dalby Spook, and she was generally kind of shunned as being weird and spooky. She said it prevented her from getting married. It's rather a sad interview to say, oh, it's all true and I wish he'd never appeared to us.
Yes, I was going to say, actually, that of the whole story, I think Vori's story is tragic in a lot of ways, and very similar in my mind, I think, to Janet from the Enfield poltergeist case, Janet Hodgson. She, again, she's one of the main protagonists in the case, but she very rarely gives interviews about it. You certainly can't argue in either case that there's any form of, you know, they're not looking for financial gain from the case. They're not looking for recognition. Janet and or Vori wasn't either. They really didn't want an awful lot to do with it.
No, they don't seem to have benefited from it. I think the closest one can get to a confession of hoax in Rory's interview in 1970 was the way that she said, if Mother and I had had our way, we'd have just kept quiet about this. But Father was kind of obsessed, and he just had to tell people about it. And that's the closest, really, she gets to hinting that it may have been a hoax. I mean, there was a general belief when I was researching this and talking to people in the area, it tends to be, because of the period, it tends to be people's sons or nephews or daughters of the actual protagonist. But they said there had been a general opinion in the area at the time that it was a hoax perpetrated by the mother and the daughter to try and get the father to move back to Liverpool. I can imagine they didn't like living on this cold, lonely, bleak farmhouse, and they would far prefer to be back in the bright lights. All I can say about that is, well, firstly, it didn't succeed because they didn't move back. And secondly, in such a small house, if the mother and the daughter were perpetrating a hoax, the father would surely have found out sooner or later. But this carries on for, as I say, 8 years, really, 1931 to 1939. And even then, there were some occasional reports of Jeff coming back for a bit and, you know, telling a few jokes and going away again. Certainly, the father seems to have been very caught up in it. And it's possible that it initially was a hoax, and he liked the attention. He liked the fact that people with Rolls Royces were coming up to visit people from all over the world. It may have fed into his ideas of being a cosmopolitan, sophisticated kind of man who, something that comes across in his letters and descriptions of himself is he's set aside from the average Manx farmer. He sees himself as a cut above. When he first moved to the island, he joined the local Freemasons Lodge, and I think that may have been in part to try and get an in into the middle class, not the farmer class, to try and work his way into the kind of society he maybe had been established in Liverpool. I guess he didn't intend to end up working on the farm. Initially, he was just buying and selling property, and I think this is what happened here. He would maybe had an idea of being a gentleman farmer, hands off, unemployed, as he did initially, just employ a few people to do the manual labour. But as times got harder, he found himself doing a lot of that himself. He seems to have been a very frustrated man, starved of intellectual stimulus. He was very keen to have people send books and newspapers and journals over there. They were very poor, so anything that he could get free in the way of books and magazines and the Listener magazine he was quite keen to get hold of. But for all that, for their great poverty, he doesn't seem to have benefited financially, and I think he could have done. He was given various offers from national newspapers for negatives or photographs that they'd ostensibly taken of Jeff, and he refused. There were a couple of other financial offers that he refused. So, again, like Janet Hodgson, money doesn't seem to have been the impulse behind this. That doesn't seem to have been the consideration.
No, indeed. And in fact, the only money that he really gains from the case at all is essentially board and lodgings for a week from one of the investigators.
Yeah, that's right. Nandor Fodor, the investigator, stayed there for a week, and he paid for his board and his vegetarian food.
Yes, I was going to say, even in that case, I mean, his catering requirement was just, I'm a vegetarian, I only eat vegetables boiled for 10 minutes in a sauce when I'm quite cheap to run, sort of thing. So
didn't even want to eat the rabbits that Jeff was alleged to have caught. Someone was certainly catching rabbits, which they'd either cook or they would sell down at the village.
So the main protagonists in this case, we've spoken about a little bit already. So there's James Irving, the patriarchal figure in the household. There's Margaret, his wife, and Voirie, their daughter. James's role is very much as a kind of recorder of the events, and as you say, he develops an obsession with the case. He's very much the one that is keeping the interest alive, if you like. Now, Margaret and Voiry are interesting characters because their roles in the case kind of change a little bit, don't they, as the case goes on?
Yeah, but one of the frustrating things I've found is that we hear very little from them. James Irving was very much head of the household. He was born in 1873, and I think the idea of a Victorian dad applies very much to him. And people commented that when they visited the house, he was doing all the talking, and if one of the others, if his wife or daughter was speaking in a way that he thought was not in the direction that he liked, he would shoot them a look and they would instantly shut up. There's quite one of my favourite photos in the book which shows this. They're all sat round a table and the two women are looking towards him at the head of the table in an attitude of some fear, I think. But as a result, we have lots and lots of his testimony and interviews and letters, very little from the other two. So it's all mediated through, or nearly all mediated through James, which means we should be a bit suspicious.
Yes.
Initially, it seems that Rory was very close to Jeff. When she was, well, I suppose 12, 13, 14, she seems to have thought of him as a playmate, and also a protector, because she was sometimes, I'll say, bullied by the other school children. As she grew older, she seemed to tire of Jeff, and she used to speak of him as a nuisance. And Mrs. Irving, Margaret, became quite preoccupied as to what Jeff's true identity or nature was. And there are several diary entries or letter entries where she's asking Jeff, I think you're a human in the form of an animal. I think you've lived on this earth before. And of course, Jeff is very enigmatic and doesn't give a straight answer or gives contradictory, as these entities tend to do. But she was, they all seem to have, the other thing I should say is they, the family's interpretation and understanding of Jeff seems to have been coloured by the newspaper reports and the visitors they were receiving and literature they were receiving. So there was tremendous interest from spiritualists and mediums. And you can see at the start, Irving is giving an interview to a journalist for, I think it's the Manchester paper, where he says, nothing that's happened is supernatural. This is all perfectly normal. I'm very sane. He's very keen to emphasise that he and his family are sane. But he seems to think it's quite possible that an animal can talk. And gradually, a year or two later, when they're subjected to the interest of spiritualist visits, letters, and sending them literature, spiritualist literature, they then seem to adopt the line that Jeff is an earthbound spirit. So he is a spirit of a person that lived some time ago, and he's somehow taken the form of a mongoose or possessed a mongoose. But they're very responsive to the outside stimuli. So initially, Jeff wasn't a mongoose. Initially, he was a weasel. And then what happened in March 1932, someone, local man, wrote a letter to one of the Isle of Man papers saying, quite rightly, 20 years previously, there'd been a farmer who'd released a dozen mongoose to control the rabbit population. And then, could Jeff be a mongoose rather than a weasel? And then thereafter, he became the mongoose. So it's all very responsive to the media. And that's why I think of it as a media sensation, perhaps something that amused and distracted from the rather grim times of the Depression, rise of fascism, Spanish Civil War, all these things were going on. Which Jeff never addresses. He never talks about politics, current affairs, which I think is something in Irving's, in the family's favour, because This is just my own view. If I was to invent a bizarre ghost or entity, I would probably give it prophecies of great import about Franco and Hitler and Mussolini. Jeff never does anything like that. He's just talking about, I went down to Peel and I stole an egg, or I snuck into the bus depot and I stole a sandwich. So it's very, very mundane.
Yes. And I mean, the thing that makes it such a media circus, I suppose, really is purely the fact that this is a report of a talking animal, isn't it? Because take away the fact that this is allegedly an animal that has learned the power of speech and a way of human thinking. It's essentially very, very trivial, isn't it, a lot of it?
Yes, surprisingly so. I expected there to be more, you know, kind of prophecies, I suppose, or grandiose. Jeff is quite grandiose. He says he's the fifth dimension and he's the eighth wonder of the world. But aside from that, there aren't any, there's no real, there are occasionally discussions about what happens after death. I suppose that's the most profound it gets. But Jeff was very reluctant to talk about death, and he seemed to be quite scared of, there was a book of ghost stories that he told James Irvin to get rid of. He didn't like that. There was one occasion, and again, I have to remind us that all this, or nearly all this, is mediated through James Irving's own diaries and letters, but Irving describes an occasion when, for a joke, he puts a white sheet over his head, so that the classic ghost, this is upstairs, and he came down the stairs going woo-woo, and he says Jeff was terrified, and he had to take the sheet off and say, it's all right, it's just me, it's a joke, and he describes how Jeff was crying with relief, and damn, do that again. There's quite a few instances of this. There was an abandoned farm about 6 miles to the south, and there's various legends attached to this farm of an unbaptized child and this sort of thing. And Jeff says, oh, would you go through there at night? I wouldn't go there. I mean, it's too scary, which is very odd, given that he's an earthbound spirit and a self-described ghost in the form of a weasel.
Absolutely. I'd like to focus a little bit on the folkloric aspects of this case, if I may. We've touched already, perhaps, on one or two things. One thing that you mentioned, kind of, for people who know my research and or have read my book on black dog folklore, we'll know that I talk quite a bit within that area about this idea of shared memory or shared consciousness or folk memory. And you've touched on a very similar thing in some respects by talking about this kind of collective mindset that develops within an isolated family. So that's perhaps one area. And I guess there are other areas as well, that the Brownies and Hobbes and fairies is obviously another one that is very folkloric. So why do you think, I mean, this is a case that many people say is a poltergeist or is some kind of haunting. They, on the Isle of Man, they refer to it as the Dolby spook. But why is this case of particular interest to us as folklorists rather than as paranormal investigators, do you think?
Well, I think in the context of the Isle of Man, particularly this region, the parish was called Patrick in the southwest, which was so rich and still is so rich in folklore. These will have been tales that all the locals will have been familiar with. Vori will have learned about these at school. Her mother, through her Manx ancestry, will have learned about these stories. It was very much alive in the area, and it has occurred to me that the reason why the story took off in the neighbourhood is that people wouldn't think there was anything that unusual about a talking animal. in a way that maybe has happened in London, it wouldn't gain such traction. So there may have been, and they didn't seem to, the local people and the news reports in the local, the Manx newspapers initially don't seem to have gone down a line of poltergeists or ghosts. It's, they compare it to the Finodery, which is the brownie or the hob, or the Bugan, which is a dreadful monster that lived just a couple of miles away, actually, by a Glenmay waterfall, but there's also a witch. So I think the whole landscape was alive with these things, and it may have been that there was a pre-established belief that such things are possible and not absurd. Having said that, there was also a large number of local people who believed it was a hoax, so that's in contradiction to it. It's a tricky one. It's because we can't go back to the 1930s and talk to the people there and ask, what do you believe? Mm. What are the basis of the witch at Glenmay Waterfall? What about the black dog at Peel Castle? These stories are still around. But I do think it was a fertile area for such a story of a talking animal to take root.
I guess the story has kind of grown up in a landscape of other folkloric tales, as you say, and taken root and developed there. And then now, looking back on it, we see it within that kind of landscape, and it just feels more like a traditional ghost story and more like this kind of otherworldly element of lore is attached to it, I suppose.
But then I think it's also been skewed by the fact that the case was popularised by Harry Price, who wrote The Haunting of Cashin's Gap, his book about the case. He was obviously a very high-profile media personality, and because he was known for exposing fraudulent mediums, seances, Bawley Rectory and so on, that's kind of coloured it in a way that I don't think it was viewed like that on the Isle of Man. It's tricky. I was speaking to a lady a couple of months ago from the island, and she said, I think I asked her a question about where does Jeff fit in this tradition, and she said, oh no, we didn't think of him as, you know, we have the fairies and the witches and the Bugan and the Kabbalishti, and Jeff isn't one of those. So I think that's maybe the hoax side of it, but she didn't see him categorised as that. I've also spoken to people who said, yes, he's absolutely a continuation. He's, although he doesn't look like the Finodery, the brownie, was a very strong, I think actually life-size man with very hairy legs, so kind of like a satyr. In fact, in the Manx Bible, it was translated into Manx, when satyrs are mentioned, I think in Isaiah, they actually use the word Finodery in a way that people would understand. This is a big, strong, hairy-legged man. Mm. So Jeff doesn't look like that. He certainly behaved like that. He was attached to a farm, to a farming family. He would help out. So Jeff reportedly would catch rabbits for the family, which was very useful because they were so poor. He would check the outbuildings if there were rats. He would find duck eggs. He would look out for lost sheep. But he was very touchy and irritable. And the other thing with these brownies, you have to feed them. If you don't feed them, they get really annoyed. So he does fit into that category. And they discussed local folklore, apparently Irving and his family, and even Jeff. But Jeff, as I say, seemed to be quite scared of the idea of ghosts and the Erie Cushland farm, which was haunted. He wouldn't go there at night. So it's rather confusing. What is he? He sometimes talked about going back to the underworld. When he would leave after talking to them for hours at a time at night, his kind of signal, meaning he was about to go, would be a cry of vanished, vanished, and then he would disappear. And once they quizzed him, so where do you go when you say vanished? And he said, oh, I go back to the underworld. He also talked of hell, the land of mists, where he came from, which I think is referring to the Conan Doyle, the Challenger story, Land of Mists, which has a spiritualist element to it.
Now, for those that don't know the full story of Jeff, the case runs, as we say, for quite a long period of time. Jeff's visits to the farmhouse, they vary in frequency, but they gradually drop off towards the end of this 8 years. Eventually, the farmhouse is sold and is taken on by another person. What happens to the case of Jeff in the end?
It seems sort of just petered out. There isn't a kind of grand finale. It was thought initially that the subsequent owner, who was an ex-army man, reported a large polecat-type animal was prowling around, which he trapped and killed, and this appeared in the local paper, and it was suggested that this was Jeff that he'd killed, but it doesn't really resemble the descriptions. The photographs depict a big 2.5-3 foot long animal. I think it's a polecat. Jeff was reportedly 6 inches long with a 6-inch tail and a weasel size. Of the subsequent tenants, occupants of the farmhouse, some claim to have heard strange noises and whisperings. Others said, oh, it's all nonsense. There was nothing untoward. By about early 1970, the owners demolished the farmhouse. Never really sure why. It struck me that when I went there, there were quite a few abandoned buildings here and there, and it would have been quite difficult, I imagine, to demolish this building because there are, as I say, no access roads. So to get the heavy machinery up there would have been hard. I suspect it was done to stop curiosity seekers like myself from going up. If the farmhouse isn't there, there's less of a focus. Because it's all on private land, it's on this farmer's land. So that may have been a motive to destroy the building. I was disappointed to see there's very little in the way of a tourist industry surrounding Jeff. When I went to Dalby, I stayed there, I kind of half expected there would be postcards and tea towels and memorabilia. In the way that if you go to Loch Ness, I understand there's two rival Nessie visitor centres. There's nothing like that at Dalby. The only thing I could see really as a kind of memory of Jeff was the Ballacallan Inn, which was a hotel pub, now sadly closed, had a big inn sign, pub sign outside, with a picture of Jeff looking very cheerful, holding up a pint. And that was about it. You talked to people, some of them knew what you were talking about, others didn't know what on earth you were talking about. So he's rather sadly forgotten in the immediate area, where, as I say, in other parts of Britain where there's a legend or folktale or myth, you know, this is commemorated.
Absolutely. And that's really surprising, I think, isn't it, as you say, because if you go to Suffolk, for example, and go to Bungay, which is one of the most famous black dog examples, you can go to the Black Dog restaurant, you know, the various other things. The Weather Vane has a black dog on it. Lots and lots of things commemorating it. You know, I mean, King Arthur is a good example for everything from cafes to car parks are named after King Arthur. But here we are, 80 plus years down the line, from Geoff's first arrival at Dawlish Cashen, we're in a position where on the Isle of Man he's not really commemorated, but here we all are remembering it, talking about it, you and I reminiscing about books from when we were at school and why we remember this so much. Why do you think that, despite what you find or don't find on the Isle of Man, the case has such an enduring appeal for everybody?
Oh, I was about to ask you that, Mark, because you said it kind of lingered with you since you read the Osborne book.
Yeah.
For myself, I feel Geoff has a very real personality, which one can detect, we can pick it up from the quotes that are recorded by James Irving. And it's kind of an endearing personality. It's not like the Bell Witch, which threatened to kill people, and I believe people were injured in that place. Geoff was very bombastic and would threaten to kill people's poultry, and he said, "I could kill all of you, but I won't." But he never did anything more malicious than stealing the bus driver's sandwiches. So I think there is that. There's a personality that people respond to in a way that the Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot or the Black Dogs, I suppose, don't really have an individual personality.
No.
Why do you think it stayed with you for so long? Do you have an idea of why it's...
I think you're right. I think there is that personality aspect. And I think one thing is that the case really is unique. There are lots of examples of black dogs. There are lots of examples of lake monsters. There are lots of examples of Bigfoot and Yowie and similar creatures. There is nothing very much similar, arguably, to Geoff. So the case has that unique quality about it. It has this personality aspect. It's very... it's very jovial and convivial. I think you remember those things for sure. But also, I think if you first came across the case in books when you were at school, then you don't associate so much. Well, you certainly don't associate with Margaret as a protagonist in the case. She's a little bit in the background, perhaps. And although he's the head of the household and a lot of the case is mediated through James Irving, you don't associate with that so much. I think if you came across the case like we did at school, you very much kind of associate with Voirie and her interplay with Geoff. And maybe that's the kind of thing that sticks with you. It's this unique quality that involves somebody of your age as a school child, but it's not frightening, it's not scary, it's just fascinating.
Yes, there's a sort of a wonderful sense to it. And I guess if we come across it at a similar age to Voirie, we can project and think, what would it be like if we were in that situation and we had this little secret companion that protected us? So it does fulfill similar role to some of the great children's fiction, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's like having an imaginary friend in some respects, isn't it? Which, of course, a lot of children do.
Yeah, I did. I did wonder if it could be explained away as an imaginary friend. It seems from what I discovered, the children's ages when their imaginary friends appear are much younger than Voirie being 12 when Geoff first appeared. But this only adds to the kind of uniqueness of it, I suppose, that it doesn't quite fit into any of these categories. I must say, I did, when I first started reading about it, I did think it was entirely, completely unique. Certainly, as you say, there are plenty of Bigfoots and plenty of black dogs, and there aren't plenty of talking mongooses. Something that both Nandor Fodor and Harry Price observed is that if this case had taken place 300 years prior to 1932, the family would have been hanged as witches. And it is striking when one looks at witch trial testimony from the early modern period, how many of these accused people, mainly women, are recorded as having witches' familiars in the form of weasels, ferrets, small animals. The Witch of Wapping, I think, had a squirrel, who invariably have a name of one syllable. So there is possibly a comparison there. It doesn't really take us much further, because it begs the question of what is a witch's familiar, but that's perhaps another connection with the past, that it seemed a commonplace for witches in the stories of witchcraft and the trials, the allegations, the belief systems that people had, that they would have a little animal, be it a ferret, a mole, or a weasel, or a mouse, to do their bidding, which is kind of what Jeff did. And I think Price and Fodor were right. I think if this had happened in the 17th century, that they, seen as outsiders as they were not quite trusted by the locals. They didn't really get the hang of farming. They spoke differently, dressed differently. They would have been seen as other. They probably would have been in danger of being persecuted and tried as witches.
I'd like to round off by just talking for a few minutes about your book and your field research. Your book on this subject, called Jeff, with a big exclamation mark after it, came out fairly recently, published by Strange Attractor Press. I'll put links to all of this in the show notes for this episode so that people can go and track it down. I knew quite a lot about this case already, but compared to what is in your book, I really knew very, very little. I have to say that it is one of the most engaging books in this field that I've read for a long time, and it taught me so much. One of the things that it did teach me, and I know has probably taught a lot of other people, is not to pronounce it Geff, which I think a lot of people do and have done for many years. I certainly spent 30 plus years.
Jeff. He couldn't really spell, so he wanted it to be G-E-O-F-F, but because he only spelled phonetically, he just would spell it G-E-F. Yeah, I think when I first started researching it, I thought it would be much simpler than it turned out to be. And I think, I felt it had been given a kind of Harry Price tinge, so it was associated with Bawley Rectory and seances and mediums. And that's only part of the story. How it was perceived and how the story was constructed on the island itself, I found very instructive, in that it wasn't quite the same. He was a spook. He wasn't a talking mongoose. There's more of an ambivalence, more of an indeterminate aspect to him, that he's something that can't be trapped. He's lurking behind the wooden panelling, or he's behind the hedge. You don't quite see him. You can hear him, but he refuses to appear. He won't describe what he is, even if he's asked pinpoint, are you an earthbound spirit? Are you a mongoose? He won't give a straight answer. He's very evasive. And I think that adds to his charm, really, that he maintains his mystery.
Yes, certainly. And it does make things very difficult to track down, doesn't it, in some respects? I think for people who are aspiring to research and write on a topic of a folkloric nature, they too could learn a lot from reading this book. Tell us a little bit about the field work and research you did. I mean, obviously we know about, you've spoken about the library documentation, the Senate House Library and other places that you worked in, but you also, and this is the most important thing for folklorists, I think, you know, went to the landscape, spoke to the people, looked at the area. How did you go about researching on the island itself?
Well, I was quite fortunate in that I initially wanted to place an advert in the local papers, just appealing for information, but they were quite thrilled that someone was writing about this. Maybe it was a slow news day that week, so they published an article. When I went there, I'd already had some contacts established from that, so I met various people, spoke to them. People would then introduce you to other people and say, oh, you should talk to, there was an old farmer who just about remembered the period. He was a young man then. So it was that, really. People were happy to talk about it. I think there was a sense of ownership. This was something that happened in their little sleepy neighbourhood. And there seemed to be some sense of pride that it was someone, oh, it's someone from the University of London, and they're writing about Jeff. So people were quite happy to talk. And as I say, in the village, a lot of people didn't know what I was talking about, but once I had a couple of newspaper articles published, then I started to get people contacting me, and then you get more and more contacts. Oh, you should try phoning him, you should go and see him. So that's how I built up an idea of, I suppose, a contradictory. On the one hand, the local people believed it was a hoax, the mother and the daughter, and on the other hand, this was something real, that continuation of the local folklore. I guess it depends who you speak to and what their own beliefs are. There wasn't a distinction between Manx people and what they call comeovers, people who come over from the mainland. There didn't seem to be a different set of views. It just depended on their own take on it, I suppose, and what they thought of the family. Some people seemed to think they were very stuck up and didn't like them. Others rather took to them and thought they were rather polite and had good manners. And I think that coloured people's views as well.
Okay, so finally, I think we can't finish without looking at this point. Here is a case in a very isolated part of an island which is not technologically advanced, is not cosmopolitan, is not any of those things. We have a family of three people. One used to sell pianos and organs. We have his wife, and we have his daughter, who at the time that this case starts is 12 years old. The case runs for 8 years. It's investigated by Fodor, it's investigated by Price, various other scientists, people of high regard. There is no definite conclusion, even today, as to what was going on. Surely, people such as Price and Fodor can't have been taken in, you wouldn't have thought, by a family in that kind of situation. So, what was going on?
Well, Price's take was one that he said he couldn't publish in his book for fear of being sued by James Irving. He subsequently wrote to one of his correspondents and said he believed it was a hoax, but not one for money. He described it as a psychological hoax, and he seems to believe that the extreme isolation experienced by the family and the great sense of worth that Irving had, that he was an important man, he was a well-travelled, sophisticated man, destined for better things than scrabbling around on a failed farm, had led to this collective delusion. Fodor had a different... Well, Fodor was trained in psychoanalysis. He was came from Hungary, so he was trained in Vienna, not under Freud himself, but Ferenczi. So he had the psychoanalytic framework with which to interpret poltergeist cases and vampire cases. And again, he seems to have thought that the case was one of Irving's thwarted ambitions. And then he talks about Jeff as a projection of the three Irving families' minds. He doesn't explain how this is done, but he points to the fact that Jeff's interests are the same as the family's interests in motor cars, planes, in animals, in different languages. So while Price says it's a hoax, Fodor says it's genuine, but it's a psychological construct, which I think is partly true. I myself lean towards poltergeist as explanation for some of the phenomena. I think it's a various overlaid aspects. So there is the thought, there is the obsession. If you believe in such things, there's the folklore. And I think it took hold in that part of the Isle of Man because of the established traditions of fairies and goblins and hobs and brownies and witches that allowed it to take root there.
I think the simple answer is that there's never going to be a simple answer to this case, isn't it? I think there are elements that are drawn from all sorts of areas. And I think that's what makes it so enduring and so fascinating. And I think it will continue to hold that fascination for many years to come.
I hope so. I certainly think Jeff would not want to be pinpointed and categorised. There was a South African spiritualist, a lady called Mrs. Gamble, who went over to the farm and she called out, "Jeff, appear, you know, make yourself known." And he supposed to have called out, "No fear, you'll put me in a bottle." So he doesn't want to be trapped in a bottle. He doesn't want to be categorised. So I hope it won't be in that way. I was always rather nervous while I was writing this book that somewhere in Cheltenham or Liverpool, someone would discover Vorey's lost diary and it would say, "It's all a hoax," in a kind of Cottingley Fairies. Fortunately, that didn't. I mean, I was actually pursuing her effects after she died and her solicitor, but I was kind of ambivalent about it because I thought, "Oh God, you know what? What if I do discover this confession?" Fortunately, that didn't materialise.
No, and I don't think it's as clear cut as somebody finding a confession from anybody in this case. I would encourage everybody to have a good long look at your book and to make up their own minds on the subject. It really will keep everybody both entertained and enthused, I think, for a long time. It's been a pleasure, Chris, to talk to you about Jeff and about this case and about your research into it, and I'm glad we've had the opportunity to bring it to a wider audience. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me.
My thanks go to Chris for a fascinating discussion on Jeff. That draws to a close this season of the Folklore Podcast. Don't worry, we carry right on with Season 3 in January, and there are some more great guests and discussions already lined up, as well as my own episodes. Thank you for your continued support, especially to the Patreon supporters who are vital for keeping this podcast going and ensuring that we have now reached Season 3. There will be more new developments in the first part of next year. So, to keep up to date, do join the Facebook and Twitter feeds and sign up for the free newsletter. Thanks for listening. See you next time. The Folklore Podcast is created and hosted by me, Mark Norman. Find out more about my writing and research at www.facebook.com/MarkNormanFolklore. The Folklore Podcast art director is Melissa Martell. Find her work at www.mdmcreate.com. The Folklore Podcast will always be free to listen to, but it is an enormous amount of work to research, create, record, and write 2 of these episodes every month. And so, we have created a simple way in which you can help to support the ongoing life of the Folklore Podcast. Please visit our website at www.thefolklorepodcast.com and click on support. There are various ways that you can help, and they don't all involve giving us money. Even just leaving a simple review on iTunes or other podcast apps helps to grow our audience. So please do visit and take a moment to help us to keep going. Thank you for listening. The Folklore Podcast theme music is written and performed by Gurdy Bird.